This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
But let's start with this. I was asking people before this, you know, if they had any questions for you. And one of the women I spoke with, she said, well, do you still believe in capitalism? And I think at the core of that question is this area you've found, which is that, look, there's this world we're looking at, this polarized world of people saying there's climate change, it's an existential crisis, we've got to do something about it, and then the other side saying, no, we're good. And I think what you have said is that there's a middle spot. There's a part where you can break through that polarization. Is that capitalism?
So before I answer that question, which I'm anxious to answer, I would like to say that every single morning when I get up, the first thing I do before I do anything else is check the Keeling curve. Because it's the best measure of where it's like taking the Earth's temperature. I want to know, and the way it gets reported, if you ever do it, is they report the number for yesterday, and they report the number for yesterday last year. So you can sit there and say, okay, here's where we are, here's the trajectory, and if you do it every single day, you kind of figure out, you don't have to have them draw the curve for you, you can sort of remember the curve. So Ralph, just so you know, every single day I get up and do it.
Where would one do that? Is there a nice...
You just go CO2 level.
Okay.
On Google, and then they give you, you can just hit it, and it takes 15 seconds to get it done every single day. Capitalism. So the great thing about capitalism, it has no morality whatsoever. So whenever you hear a capitalist explaining that it's about, you know, doing the right thing and integrity, you can know that they're lying. That's not true. Capitalism basically is an incredibly efficient system for getting things done. And so, and I'll give you an example. The two things in this world that scale, and obviously climate change is a global problem, so we need scale solutions. The two things that scale are government and profits. And so if you think about things that have changed, if someone came into this room and said, everybody's got to go to the draft board tomorrow, we're going to put you in jail, pretty much everybody would go to the draft board. And as an example of why profits are so big, I have a friend at Stanford who's an excellent material scientist, you know, world-class material scientist, has a big lab supported, he has $3 or $4 million a year in lab to support his lab research. And he came up with a new battery, a longer living battery, completely different from lithium ion. $400 million is what he raised. Profits scale. Capitalism scales. If you want to deploy something, you think about the things that have gotten really big, they're companies that are very profitable. But let's also remember that in the context of the United States, and I don't even need to go to the worst stuff, it was legal to employ a 12-year-old for a 14-hour day and pay him a quarter. That was the law, and everybody did it. And so when we think about what's right, and we think about what's good for society, we absolutely need to have somebody putting up the framework for how the world is supposed to work and what's permissible. And that's why we have a democracy. So when you say capitalism, I say, okay, incredibly efficient, incredibly effective, but people within capitalism, and we see it, if you'll excuse the expression, right now, that they excuse whatever they have to do by saying, I have to take care of my shareholders. That is an excuse for anything. It has been an excuse for literally anything in American history. So when we think about it, and I know that there's a lot of people are extremely unhappy with how our capitalist system is working. It's really not the capitalism, it's the impact of capitalism on our politics. And when you think about if the whole point about, I'll make one last very simple point. I really believe in dispersed decision-making in every place. And the great thing about democracy, everybody gets a vote. If it's fair, everybody gets a vote, everybody gets the same vote. It's dispersed throughout society, and dispersed decision-making is much better than any group of people making concentrated decisions, always. And the great thing about capitalism, it's dispersed decision-making. In the USSR, people would get together in a room and try and figure out how many nails to make. We don't do that. We have 330 million Americans going to the store and buying nails when they need them. That's dispersed decision-making. That's what I love about capitalism. But when the people control the means of production and use it to impact how the rules are set and what the framework is that they work within to the disadvantage of everybody else in society, that is a deep perversion of democracy. And that's where we get in trouble.
Your book was Cheaper, Faster, Better. Came out last year, right? And it was extremely optimistic about what humans are going to be able to do about these existential challenges. A lot has happened in the last year since then. Are you still optimistic? What is the state of the situation through your eyes?
So when we think about the energy transition, it's really not a question of being optimistic or pessimistic. There's just the facts. And so if we look around the world and see what's happening in the world in terms of who's winning, what my point was, for this to work, we have to win in the marketplace. If we want solar power has to win in the marketplace. If we want EVs, people have to want to buy EVs. Okay, so let's go to the videotape. Last year, 2024, new electricity generation in the world. So power plants, whatever. Over 90% renewable. Over 90% renewable. If you look at EVs, and the thing is, in the attention economy, you would think the exact opposite was true. You would think fossil fuels are crushing. They're so cheap. Everyone loves fossil fuels. That's not true. If you go around the world, as an example, Pakistan increased their electricity generation last year by 50%, all renewable, just by people buying solar panels. All around the world, individual people, without going to their utility, without going to their government, are buying solar panels and putting them up in their houses or hanging them off their balconies because they're so much cheaper. So when you say, am I optimistic this is going to happen? It's kind of like, I'm also optimistic that the sun will rise tomorrow. It's happening lickety-split. The issue from an environmental standpoint is this. I'm sure you guys know that a $20,000 EV in China is an amazing car. A $10,000 car in China is a pretty good car. So do I think that that's going to win in the marketplace around the world? Yes. The issue that we have is we're winning in the marketplace, but the sales, every time you buy an EV, they don't retire an internal combustion car. The fact is, I think there was an expectation that as we built renewables, we would be retiring fossil fuel plants. And because of burgeoning demand for electricity, the truth is we're not. The fossil fuel plants are staying in use longer than anyone would have expected. And when you really go to the videotape in terms of the marketplace, electrification is happening. It's going to happen. Combusting fossil fuels is incredibly wasteful. Electricity is inherently much cheaper. 80% of the people in countries in this world do not have fossil fuels, so they can have their own energy from solar and wind. They don't have to depend on the United States and the Persian Gulf to send them fossil fuels. So that's a huge difference. And as the prices go down, international competition and success of countries and economies are based on the cost of energy. And so this is absolutely happening. From an environmental standpoint, because there's such demand, we're not replacing these fossil fuel plants. So if you actually looked at the Keeling curve, or you actually looked at emissions year to year, we were supposed to reduce emissions 40% this decade. They're not down. Last year, they were up less than 1%, 0.8%. The estimates for this year are to be basically somewhat similar, somewhere between flat to up a little bit. So I could tell you a lot of things that are good, but the ultimate scorecards are we're not reducing emissions, we are winning in the marketplace, and we're going to continue to kill in the marketplace.
Well, to your point, let's say we do a, somebody out in the audience does a tweet with a picture of this event. That tweet is essentially like turning on a little light bulb that has to go on forever. The amount of energy that the internet and that AI is demanding is soaring. And that's what you're talking about, right? The explosive demand and our effort to meet it is hurting our chances to make progress on the Keeling curve on emissions. What is the, when we point to renewables, one of the main problems people point out is the ability for people to power their homes or whatever at night. The battery infrastructure is not there to do that. Where are we in that process? You mentioned there's some promising scientists, but it doesn't feel like the batteries are going to get where we need as fast as we need.
Okay, so let me rephrase that question so that I can see if I can answer it somewhat succinctly. Basically, the idea of intermittent power, wind and solar, which is much cheaper per kilowatt hour, but which is obviously not around 24/7, 365. And then you have utility grade batteries, which just, I'm sure a lot of you know, a utility grade battery holds a charge for 4 hours. And so even though the costs have gone down 90% for batteries in the last decade, and we think will go down another 90% this decade, the question is, if you need to have certainty about 24/7, 365, 4 hours is not enough. And so we can go a lot further than we are on the grid in terms of putting in renewables, but we can never completely replace fossil fuels until batteries last longer. Let me say that my belief is that we'll have a couple of revolutions in batteries, not just in cost, but also in duration in the next 5 to 7 years, where we will have many multiples of 4 hours. But you know, it's like all technologies. I think it will happen. It has to happen in the real world for it to be proved. The other things that are going on, there's an advanced geothermal, and I don't know how many of you guys have followed this, but basically geothermal is like Old Faithful. It's steam and hot water under the earth. It used to be that all of the geothermal power was down to 500 feet. People are now going down 5,000 to 10,000 feet. They believe that as much as 15% of all energy by 2050, all electricity, will be powered by geothermal. Is that true? TBD. But it is being developed now, it is being sold real time for some, you know, a very reasonable price. And if it's real, a lot of it in the world, which I would think there is, then that is something which can be a real change. This is also why people are spending so much time talking about nuclear, because it's 24/7, 365. And that's both new fission, which would be small reactors, and I could take you through the arguments. Once again, it's a guess. It's an assumption. It's extrapolating current information to where you think you're going. And also nuclear fusion, which is basically creating the sun on the planet Earth. So for all the scientists here, I'm sure you know this, but it's 100 million degrees. And you know, I think I invested in it in 2006, and they told me it'd be 20 years. People now think that it could be available in the 2030s, but I can tell you that in 2016, 10 years after I invested, the people sent a note to the investors like me, and they said, total home run. We have crushed it. We have created nuclear fusion for a millionth of a second. And I thought, oh my God, this is a really hard job. A millionth of a second, oh God, this will never work. I don't think that company will work.
You have Google and Amazon, Microsoft, they're all investing or partnering with small modular reactors, nuclear power plants. Are you saying that's part of the solution or?
Look, this is what I will say. My personal bet is that the actual answer is gonna be renewables. And so when we think about what's going on in the world, we're thinking about it from an American context, and we're thinking about it in terms of data centers where they need 100% reliability. In most of the world, you know, India is going to have, as 1.4 billion people, they'll have five times as much electricity in 2050 as now. We're growing by 2% a year, and we're like, whoa, 2% a year, it's killing me. They're going to go 5x. So when we think about the world is doing renewables. And the question for the United States is, I tried to give you a big smorgasbord of choices. I still believe the way we're going to end up is going to be renewables plus batteries. But I also, I don't think we'll end up doing all of those different things, but people are going to spend billions or tens of billions of dollars to see if they can drive down the curve.
The Trump administration has savaged funding for renewable energy infrastructure, for the Inflation Reduction Act, which had the single biggest investment in climate reduction policies and infrastructure. Again, you say there's nothing stopping this revolution, just like nothing stopping the sun rising, but that certainly doesn't help. What is your analysis of how much damage that has done to the progress, or will it free people up in some way?
Well, again, I would distinguish between the US and the world. And in the world, if you go around the world, which I do, everyone else in the world is still convinced that the world is getting hotter and that it's a problem. Everybody else is still convinced that we need to put in rules to try to make sure that that doesn't happen at an acceptable level. In the United States, so do I think that if when you look globally, that's going to continue to happen? It really is. It really is. I don't think anyone is ever going to go over and build a new coal plant in Kenya. I just don't think so. It just doesn't make any sense. Everybody in Kenya is just buying solar panels. I think in the United States, when you look at getting rid of the Inflation Reduction Act, there are multiple layers of this. But the one that people are focused on is canceling basically wind and solar projects, and famously canceling a big one off the shore of Rhode Island that was owned by a Danish company called Ørsted. So I'm going to talk about that, but first let me say this. You're still allowed to finish the projects if you've started them by a certain date and completed them by a certain date. So ironically enough, people are jamming through as many projects as they can right now. So that when we look at what comes on in 26 and 27, it's actually going to be more than was projected because everyone's like, we got to, you know, get on our horse and get this done. When you, obviously, they canceled, I believe, with no justification or legality, an 80% completed offshore wind project off Rhode Island. Why would you do that? Because obviously these people are short of power, it will cause prices to go up, people are short, and you basically are breaking the law to stop people from completing something that's been approved. And the answer was, I think it was like, defense purposes. I mean, completely unclear justification for breaking a contract. So whether it works or not, who knows? But I'll say this, why would you do that? Okay, it's off the shore of Rhode Island, a blue state. It's wind, and this administration doesn't like wind. And Ørsted is a Danish company. And Denmark is the country that controls Greenland. Oh, I got it. So what's going on? Look, there are going to be political attempts. There are political attempts to try and change the course. But the history of trying to stop economic forces with political power is a history of black markets and failure.
There's a lot of damage that can be done in the meantime. Like if we do enter a world where everything's transactional, everything's what peace can the Trump family or Trump administration get, or what, you know, we've seen him take stakes in actual companies. Will the market be able to perform with that kind of transactional culture?
So obviously, the most important thing probably for a successful, prosperous country as well as a decent country is the rule of law. And if you look around the world and see who is actually prosperous, throughout the world, the prosperous countries have the rule of law. There are laws, people have to obey them, and there's basically an attempt at an objective court system. And when you do away with that, it's terrible for the country. But if you look around the world, and I keep coming back to this, but people are inherently doing, I mean, I wrote a book called Cheaper, Faster, Better. Well, they're going for cheaper, faster, better. And everything that's cheaper is getting more cheaper. And everything that's faster is getting even faster. And the stuff that's better is really a lot better. So as long as you're pointing a gun at somebody and saying, you have to buy my expensive, dirty, crummy stuff, they're gonna go like, okay, that makes sense. But you can't point a gun at everybody all the time. So when we look at this world, do I think that this revolution is inherently happening? Yes. Can the United States step out of the competition and decide to stay basically on whale blubber? Yes. We can, you know, it's possible for us to decide we're going to go with the wrong technology, the old technology. But there has unquestionably been a change. The old legacy technology is fossil fuels. Super powerful, super, you know, profitable, very concentrated, amazing political power trying to hang on. The new way of doing things is clearly electricity, renewables. It's better, it's cheaper, and it's going to win. Can people hang on? They're trying like hell to hang on. I got it. But the truth is, really, right down to the physics of it, it won't work. And so if can people who choose to do the Betamax, like do the Betamax and lose a lot of money? I believe they can.
You do a lot of thinking about politics, about California politics. This state, this city is really good at setting goals. And then it's really good at getting freaked out when it comes to delivering on them. So a good, you know, we'll pass 100% or a, you know, we're gonna cut emissions 50% or eliminate, you know, net greenhouse gas emissions. But then when it comes to charging people to drive their car, vehicle miles traveled, we freak out. We say we're gonna build a lot of dense housing in these areas. It's gonna be able to support a transit system. And everybody's like, well, that's a great idea. And then when it comes to actually building them, they freak out, they back off. Over and over and over again, it's so easy for this state, this city, this region to set a goal, and then when it comes down to doing it, they back off. Should we abandon the hope that government restrictions can get us where we want? Is there enough market power, or is there a role for government sort of to put the cap, the regulation down to force the change?
So I think California has pretty much been accepted as the stereotype of the perfect is the enemy of the good. That unless it's perfect, we won't do it. Unless, since nothing is perfect, we don't do anything. And I think it's obviously there's been a change in the last quarter, in the last 3 months or 6 months, where basically people around the state are saying, we just can't do that anymore. And let's talk about housing for a second, because Scott, you were talking about housing. Okay. I was also talking to some people about how expensive it is to live in San Diego or La Jolla, California. Yeah, I think affordability, the ability of people to rent or, God forbid, own a house in California seems absolutely overwhelming to young people and middle-aged people. And that is a huge problem. You know, the people of California cannot afford to live in California. That seems like a problem. And why would that be true? And it's not just that it's so beautiful when we step outside those doors. It is so beautiful when we step outside those doors. But we're like 3 million housing units short. Not building houses when people want to live here means there's no housing for the people who want to live here. Why do we have a homeless problem? That's why. It's not free not to do stuff. It's incredibly expensive. You know, you have people doing these amazing commutes. You have incredibly jammed roads. And you have people living on the street. So when we think about the cost of the perfect, it's extremely high. And we've got to understand, and I'll give you an example of something that I thought. I have a friend who's a, you know, in his 70s, Californian, very, 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 very smart, went to Stanford Business School, you know, has a super fancy education. And I was talking to him about offshore wind probably 2 months ago. And I said, because I feel like we got to do this. It seems like a straightforward thing that we can do. We need electricity. Let's do it. And he said, I'm absolutely opposed to offshore wind. I said, okay. What do you not like about offshore wind? Because nowadays, you can put the turbines far enough out, you can't even see them because the curve of the earth hides them. So you can't even say it's ruined your view. He said, putting the turbines in, you have to pound, and it hurts the whale's ears. Which I'm sure, I was like, whoa, never heard that. But is that enough not to have offshore wind? Because if we're not going to have offshore wind, what are we going to have? And in every one of these cases, it's not perfect. I'm sure it does hurt the whale's ears, without teasing. But at some point, we've got to have, if we want to have an economy, we've got to have electricity. We have I think we have the second most expensive electricity in the United States of America. We need to produce electricity so that businesses can survive, so everybody can have jobs. And the idea that we're going to do it in a perfect way that's not going to disturb anything is completely unrealistic. So in answer to your question, we're going to have to build more housing, and it's going to have to be more concentrated and probably higher. That's where we are. Is that what everybody wants? No. But do we have to do it to take care of the people of this state so people can afford their rent, can have a chance to buy a house, can bring up their kids? Yes. We need to take care of the people of this state for this state to survive. And we have to do it in a responsible way, and that's what government's for, a responsible way. But we still have to do it.
One of the controversial bills that just went through was SB 79. It allows for taller construction near transit hubs. Very controversial. It went through. I believe you supported it. And yet, that's another one of those, I think, central mandates that is important to do, because none of these individual cities, San Diego maybe accepted, are going to pass on their own. Much of San Diego already has what's in SB 79. But are those centralized reforms the key to getting it across California?
Well, I think that it's got to happen in the localities. But I'll give you an example of what I know. So I'm from San Francisco. So I know San Francisco politics a little bit better. I follow them a little bit closer. And I know that we're changing the height limitations in parts of San Francisco that's going to allow 36,000 more units just by changing it. There's a whole bunch of issues for the people who are very familiar with real estate. It's not just about zoning. It's not just about permitting. It's also about costs. And so there's a whole bunch of things that are going to have to happen for us to be able to produce enough houses to change the dynamic, change the pricing, and change the affordability. We're going to have to do it. This is a state which traditionally has been able to do incredible things. We are still doing incredible things, but what's happening is it's not being shared, that the infrastructure is not taking care of the people of this state in dramatic ways. And everybody knows it, and everybody's upset about it, and we really need to make a change, which means we have to do things differently.
You mentioned the whale's ears, and I think we all agree, like, there is some level of sacrifice worth the long-term benefits. But there are a lot of costs, environmental costs, landscape, you know, these vast solar farms, the wind farms. These aren't resource neutral things. These are very intense uses of resources. There's massive solar farms, you know, covering entire ecological areas. Are we really at the point of disregarding those impacts?
Absolutely not. I mean, my point to you was, why was I pushing offshore wind? Because they're really limited impacts that I know of. If the real problem is whale's ears, I can deal with it. I'm not going to stay up at night feeling bad about it. If we destroy the earth because we cover it with solar panels, that's a real cost. So let me talk to you about that for a second. one of the things we are doing that we have to do that's going to be critical to how we think about this is to use the existing footprint. How many of the flat roofs in California have solar panels on them? We don't need to permit those roofs. They're already built. We may need to change the rules for who gets to generate and sell electricity. That is doable, but it's a lot easier to put solar panels on all the flat warehouses in this state than it is to go through permitting and all the other issues. And that's just one example. You know, when we think about the grid, you know, there's a ton of projects that are ready to go, but they can't get access to the grid. And, you know, and okay, to rebuild a grid, a friend of mine built a grid from the biggest wind farm in the country, which is in Wyoming, to California, because he wanted to sell expensive power in California. Took him 18 years to build the grid. 18 years. And I said, and he then sold it. You know, the data centers happened, AI happened. He's got a great price. I said, would you ever do that again? He goes, I'd rather put my eyes out. But the grid is only 42% efficient. That's the number. We have an ability with the kind of real-time information we have and AI to change that dramatically. So if you change it from 42 to 62, that's like rebuilding half the grid. It's every time, think about the existing footprint. Let's be creative about what we have and using it in a new way.
Well, Tom and Ralph wanted to make sure we got your voices involved. Do you have questions? I think we have a microphone that can go around. Do you think that on that note that there's a movement in San Diego that the city or a nonprofit organization purchase the investor-owned utilities lines and take it over and run it, that the investor-owned utilities themselves are causing the barriers that keep us from building the kind of things you're talking about?
Okay, so the way utilities are set up based on technology that's about 120 years old. And the idea was that we do central generation, a single power line from the generation that goes out and then gets distributed. And as a result, the concept was we're going to only have one, which makes it a monopoly. And a monopoly inherently is inefficient and unfair. So we're going to have a public utilities commission to control the monopoly. That's an investor-owned utility, including the one down here, including all the ones in California. The incentives are very weird. The incentives in an investor-owned utility are you get it permitted by the PUC, you spend the money, and you get a return on it. That's the model. It's not like you have to make sales, you don't have to compete, you just need to get the PUC to okay it. It goes into the rate base and you get your return. Do I think that that's the best way to do this? No. Look, obviously, what I said earlier was about why do I love capitalism? It's real-time dispersed decision-making. Why do I love democracy? Because everybody is smarter than any smaller group of people. So when I look at electricity generation, do I think it's important for us to be able to bring in the new technologies and not wait for a very concentrated group of people to tell us what we're allowed to do? Do I think that that is a way for us to move forward, to create cheap electricity, to basically build the new infrastructure we need? Yes, I think we need to change the way those rules work to try and adapt to the technology that's here, to the opportunities that are here. And trust, you know, I spend a lot of time on new technologies and energy. There are a lot of them. There are real opportunities here for change. And I believe if we let that happen, we'll have all ubiquitous, very cheap electricity in California, but also around the world.
We got one here.
The problem is right now we have 3,550,000 pounds of nuclear waste on the beach. And it's a pressing priority for Southern California. It's a disaster waiting to happen. And how do we get the word out? And thank you very much, Scott Lewis, for the journalists. You know, we support journalists.
Thanks,
what do we do?
So let's talk for 1 second about nuclear fission, the old-fashioned type. So to be clear, the nuclear waste is incredibly toxic, and it is incredibly toxic for 100,000 years. And just so you know, the strategy in terms of getting rid of it and how to put it in a safe place does not exist. There is no strategy. Like, they thought they had a strategy, which was to stick it in Yucca Mountain, and the people in Nevada said, absolutely not. So the strategy right now, believe it or not, is to keep it where it is. Like, we have no strategy, so we'll just leave it wherever it is and hope that we come up with a strategy in the future. When I was talking about nuclear, I was saying, look, there are real issues. There's the chance of a nuclear disaster a la Fukushima. There's the issue about toxicity and nuclear waste, and there's the cost. So when you're sitting here thinking about electricity generation, every one of those has to be solved. And the answer has been, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. And to be fair, there's really been very, very, very few nuclear power plants built in the United States after Three Mile Island, like maybe one or two. But one of them was completed last year. And I think it was literally something like, I might be somewhat wrong, 6 times over budget.
Yeah.
And so it came in at like this incredibly expensive energy. So, you know, the idea is it's supposed to be super cheap and efficient, but every time it happens in the real world, it isn't. So Scott asked me the question about, you know, what is the way we're going to do this? And I was trying to give you all the different choices, but I was saying, I think the place where we can see it is renewables and batteries, and there's technology for that to happen. And here are the other things that we can do. You never know, looking forward in technology, exactly what's going to happen. But these are three serious issues that the nuclear industry has to deal with before they, you know, and there's a lot of arguments, and I could give them to you about why they're going to overcome them. But in the real world, you know, you can say you can overcome them, but overcoming them is tough.
Hey, thanks. I'm Lynn Talley from Here at Scripps. Just a quick question as a citizen resident of San Diego. Who put the knife in rooftop solar? Why did they do it? And do you agree with them?
So first of all, the reason they did it was because they were getting energy at the times they didn't want it in huge supply, and they felt they were overpaying for it. The issue to me is, okay, they couldn't use it on the grid at the times. So they basically said, we're going to make it incredibly unprofitable to put up solar on your house unless you also put up a battery. And then it'll be okay. But of course, that's a much bigger expense. Once you put, you know, solar on the roof is not that expensive. Solar with batteries is pretty expensive.
Well, the other issue was that if the people who could afford solar were, you know, not paying for the grid, then the people
right.
who couldn't afford solar were paying
for
the
grid. And so my answer is, okay, the real question here is about the grid, but it's also why, okay, maybe I can just do my own solar, and maybe I'm going to do more solar than I can do, so I'm just going to sell it to Scott. And
your point is to put as much solar on rooftops as possible.
And be able to sell it.
They need to figure out the structure for doing that, but get it out there.
But so look, we do this thing, just so you know, at our investment firm, we buy warehouses and basically decarbonize them by 150%. So what does that mean? That means we're reducing the amount of electricity it uses by 1.5 times what it uses, which means we're definitely producing more energy than we need, which means we have to sell it to other people. And so the question is there, we can easily sell it to other industrial users. But the question is, okay, if we can create this solar energy very cheaply and we can use it for ourselves, and this means everybody, you know, if you look at Kenya, there are people just putting up solar panels. There's no one else involved. In Germany, people just hang solar panels off their balconies. There's no permission, there's no discussion, they just do it. The question is, why can't we do those things? what, you know, what is the law that says, no, you have to pay us? And you know, the argument has been, exactly, you're screwing the people who don't do that. But if solar panels are really inexpensive and everybody can do it, who are you screwing?
Thanks. I haven't heard you say anything tonight about the sort of consumption side of the equation. Is it, can we, obviously our, the way our civilization is currently wired, we have a voracious need for energy, but is it pie in the sky to envision a future civilizational endeavor where we're tamping down human demands on the planet rather than endlessly accommodating them? I'm just wondering if, is there a way to deal with insatiability? Is insatiability a human right?
No. Look, obviously, if we don't do that, we're dead. I mean, the ability, people, we're here talking about climate, we're talking about energy, we're talking about CO2 emissions and methane, okay? Here's what we're not talking about. We're not talking about biodiversity. We're not talking about plastic pollution. We're not talking about toxicity in our environment that everybody in this room is subject to, whether they like it or not and whether they know it or not. And is that actually sustainable? No. So your basic question is, at some point, to rephrase it in the way that I would see it, at some point, does the information available to us and the way that we do things enable us to actually reduce all of the inputs to our lifestyles? It has to. And I think that's two things. One is to reduce the inputs, and the second is to recycle the outputs.
I think you're kind of mirroring this abundance discussion that's going on, right? Like this, and I think part of the argument is that our politics aren't just divided by left and right, they're divided by one side saying, like, you guys can chill out and do whatever you want, and the other side saying, like, you gotta feel bad all the time about plastics, about wildlife, about, you know, consumption. And that side that says stop worrying is winning. And it's taking more and more people, it feels like. And I don't know how that squares if you gotta win the political argument too. And it feels like what you're trying to embrace is like, okay, well, we can win by abundance, by making sure everybody has something and still corrects the market for the environment.
Well, it's funny, Scott, because I want to go back to your original question, which was, what about capitalism?
Yeah.
And I said, capitalism's completely immoral. And what you're saying is there are a lot of people in our society who are saying, I should be allowed to pollute for free, and I insist on that right. That's really what the climate question is about. And I should be, you know, we should be able to put, you know, I think, isn't the story that all of us have a teaspoon of plastic in our brains at this point? I should be able to do that freely. And if it gives you cancer, that's your problem. Really? So if you think there's not a need for government, that would seem to me to be pretty clearly a desperate need for government. And so in answer to your question, my original point was, if we want to do things efficiently, there is a system to do that. But if there's nobody putting it, if the people running that system also run the political system, and we don't have dispersed democratic decision-making with a framework that protects people, we're dead. And your point is, yeah, we are dead. So in my mind, we really have to take back the democratic system and take it away from people who think they have a right to make money and put the costs on everybody else. And I'll give you an example. Okay, there's no carbon tax. A carbon tax is so unfair. No one should have to pay for CO2. Okay, who paid for CO2? Pasadena paid for CO2. Altadena paid for CO2. A bunch of little girls in Girl Scout camps in Texas paid for CO2. There's no question there are the costs. The question, who's gonna bear the costs? And the whole point of government is it's not supposed to be completely unfair. And if we allow the people who have the most money to write the rules for themselves, we will have the rules we have. And it's, you know, I think there's no question here in California, we have an incredibly successful private sector We should be incredibly proud of it. The people in this room are a big part of it. It's all knowledge-based, you know, innovation, entrepreneurship, new stuff, really smart people, you know, really concentrated hard work, taking a lot of risks. We also need to make sure that the system serves everybody, 40 million people in the state of California.
Well, thank you, Tom Steyer.
The last thing I want to say is this. I do travel around the United States. It is incredibly fun to be in California with Californians. And we should remember that. This is what it's supposed to be like. Just saying.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.